All right, we're in Mark chapter 1. We've talked a little bit about the synagogue in Capernaum. We're in verses 21 through 28, that little section there, where Jesus has already called his disciples, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, and they are in Capernaum at that moment, and they decide to go to the synagogue. And we talked a little bit about Capernaum and about how in the first century it had a population of about 1,500, which means the potential for someone, for the people being at the synagogue was 1,500, because they were all Jewish. There is that potential. We looked at the synagogue a little bit and how there were different speakers that would often come to the synagogue, and usually rabbis and scribes, but sometimes a distinguished guest could come and be part of and offer their whatever they want to say. And Paul was among those, as we see in Acts chapter 13. And we also see Jesus was among those. Jesus was likely known to the people in this area because he was raised in Galilee, raised in Nazareth, not too far from Capernaum. And so Capernaum is where he decided to make his headquarters, essentially. And we see this in Matthew chapter 4 and verse 13. He sets up camp in Capernaum, and this is where he always went back to whenever he would go off and preach, up until he went before his trek to Jerusalem. He went to Jerusalem several times during his life, during his ministry, but before his final trek to Jerusalem. All right, so let's look at Mark chapter 1. We can reread a couple of these things to help us refamiliarize ourselves with this. Would someone read verses 21 through 28, Mark chapter 1?
Then they went into Capernaum. Immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and taught. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Now there was a man in their synagogue with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, saying, "Let us alone. What have we to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? Did you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be quiet, and come out of him." And when the unclean spirit had convulsed him and cried out with a loud voice, he came out of him. Then they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? What new doctrine is this? For with authority he commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And immediately his fame spread throughout all the region around Galilee.
All right, thank you. We have two instances in this short eight-verse section that in which the people there were amazed. It says, different words for that. In verse 22, they were astonished. And later in verse 27, they were all amazed. Why were they astonished in verse 22?
He knew what he was talking about.
They knew
it? The manner in which he was speaking, the probably the fact that he wasn't just reading from the Torah, but was speaking from it.
It says specifically that he was teaching with authority, as one having authority, and not as the scribes. How do you suppose the scribes would have taught? Maybe you've heard this before, that's why I ask. So the scribes often, and the rabbis and the teachers at the time, they would cite the scriptures and say, okay, this is what the scriptures say, according to this, according to that, according to this. They would also look at different commentators, as it were, and different other knowledgeable scholars at the time and previously. And they would say, okay, it was just as this person said, and this person says this, and this person says that. But Jesus wasn't like that. We just finished our series on Sunday mornings and during the sermons about the Sermon on the Mount. And would someone look at Matthew 7? We didn't read this. I don't think we read this in that. But in Matthew chapter 7, verses 28 and 29, the verses right after Jesus finishes the Sermon on the Mount.
And so it was, when Jesus had ended these sayings, that the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes.
All right, so in his Sermon on the Mount, it is a similar situation. Perhaps some of his teachings were not privy to what he taught here in the synagogue in Capernaum in Mark chapter 1. But we do see that he taught with authority. And when we look at the Sermon on the Mount, can you think of different phrases that might lend this idea that he taught with authority?
Wow. Okay. Well, I was standing there listening to all that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he's not saying, one of those passages, he says, well, you've heard it said, but I say this. You've heard it said, thou shalt not murder, do not murder. But I say, don't have hatred in your heart for your brother. You've heard it said, do not commit adultery. But I say, don't have lust in your heart for anyone else. Did you?
Yes, yeah, any of the commentators that the scribes would have been referencing would have been rabbis. And it would have been rabbis of various schools of thought. Like Gamaliel or something like that.
Sure, like Pharisees said.
But then Jesus, in 26, right before that in Matthew, says, but everyone who hears these sayings of mine.
Yep.
The only source that he quotes outside of the scripture is himself.
Himself, that's right. Did Jesus have authority?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. He certainly did. All authority, we see at the end of Matthew, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to him. And we can see that throughout Matthew. As well, that he has the authority. Do we have that authority to teach like that today?
His word, long as we're preaching his word, yes.
I would say no. And here's what I mean. Jesus has all authority. If we're going to cite anybody, we've got to cite him and his word. Right, and you're like, yeah, and you're saying, yeah, from his word, and that's true. But the rabbis often would quote from the scriptures as well, what they knew of the scriptures at that point. But for us, I can't go up here and say, yeah, you heard it said in the scriptures this, but here's what I'm going to say. I don't have that kind of authority. I can't do that. And no one in this room can do this. No one on this planet can do this. The authority comes from Jesus. And it comes from his word, because his word is inspired by the Holy Spirit. All right. So it says that they were astonished at this. Would you be astonished if somebody were to come up here and say, yeah, the scriptures say this, but I say this? Would you be astonished if someone did that?
It wouldn't last very long in this place.
Honestly, I'd be a little offended. Yeah. Honestly, I'd be quite offended if somebody did that. I'd be like, who does this person think he is?
You know, there are people who stand in that pulpit and they will say something similar, not those exact words, but they will preach aloud about something that the scripture doesn't say right or wrong here. Maybe get up there and they will say, you know what I'm trying to say, they'll preach and they think the preaching is true, but they're not.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the wolf in sheep's clothing. It's easy to know when somebody says, it says this, but I think that.
Right.
But when they slip it in, or, you know, establish it nice and smooth and slowly, like an eloquent speaker, like we've seen so many throughout the years.
Yeah.
One who's revered highly in Charlotte.
Did Jesus say anything that was contrary to the law? To the Old Testament? No, not really. I mean, he said, pardon?
He fulfilled the law.
He fulfilled the law. You know, and when he said, you've heard it say, don't murder. When he said, don't have hatred in your heart for your brother, there's principle in the Old Testament for that. We shall love your neighbor as yourself, right? And you can't do that if you have hatred in your heart for him. Don't lust after somebody. Well, that's part of what we consider the 10th commandment. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, right? That's one of that's a part of that. So that's a form of lust. So those things are present in the Old Testament in some form or another and can be taught from there. But Jesus, he didn't cite any of the scribes, any of the rabbis, or anybody like that. He spoke with authority. Yeah.
And the it's in John 8, when Jesus says, most assuredly I say to anyone who keeps my word shall never see death, and the Jews really kind of got all upset in the same kind of way.
Yeah.
They said, now we know you have a demon. Abraham is dead and the prophets, and you say if anyone keeps my word, you'll never taste death. Are you greater than our father Abraham who's dead and the prophets who are dead? Who do you make yourself out to be?
Yeah.
I mean, they said the same thing.
Yeah.
Who do you think you are?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they were, you know how sometimes you're in a situation and you are shocked to the point where you should react, but you don't. You don't think about the good response until later. I have a feeling that's kind of like how they were. They're like, wait a second. Is he speaking with authority? What is going on here? This is amazing. Keep in mind also that the people there had an expectation of a Messiah coming, right? They had some kind of expectation, first off, of Elijah coming, and many of them did recognize that John the Baptist was some kind of prophet, and some did think he might have been Elijah. And then we see in the spirit of Elijah, and so we see that they might have some expectation of who Jesus is, because later they ask him questions like, who are you? Are you the prophet? Are you Elijah? Who are you? And so but at this point, they're just astonished at what's going on. This word for astonished implies that they were struck with amazement as by a 2x4. Like, you're shocked to the point where you don't react. And so that's, so we don't react other than the shock and amazement. And so that's the kind of amazement and astonishment that they had. Couple that with what happens right after he teaches with authority. Since the synagogue worship was somewhat similar to our worship service today, imagine for a moment that some man comes up here and teaches with authority, just like they did there, and then someone else in the audience just stands up unprovoked and starts shouting and saying things like, I know who you are, the Holy One of God. How would you react? Honestly, if someone were to shout that in a worship service, what would you think?
You act like you just did.
Yeah, like, what is going on? What in the world? And of course, they were amazed too. Of course, they were amazed at that and also about what happened right after. We certainly would take notice, wouldn't we? Now, imagine, right after that, someone saying, be quiet and come out of him. And then the unclean spirit comes out and a man convulses on the floor. He just and falls to the ground. How would you react? Wouldn't you be amazed? And certainly we see that here, their reaction in verse 27. They were amazed at what was happening. This word implies that they were also frightened. Wouldn't that also be frightening? It's like, what is going on? Certainly it was a frightening sight. When we look at this particular passage and this casting out of this unclean spirit, I use on the board the word exorcism. simply because it's a shorter word than saying casting out an unclean spirit. And it's not a word we find in the Bible, exorcism, but it's a word that describes what is going on here. And I have on the board, on the left, right, I know my left, I know my right, on the right here, all the miracles that are talked about in the book of Mark. And you might notice also in orange, the letters that are right next to that. And you might have been able to guess what that means. If it has an L, then that miracle is also in the Gospel of Luke. If that has an M, then it's also in Matthew. If it has a J, it's also in John. If it has just a line, then it is unique to Mark. And so, of course, some of these have it's in several of the gospel accounts. This first one is only found in Luke. Most of the rest of them are found in Matthew as well. And then a couple of them are in John. There's one that I find fascinating that's in all four gospel accounts. The only one is the feeding of the 5,000. Now, what I want to point out is that these are specific miracles. There are several instances that it says Jesus went around healing people, casting out unclean spirits, and doing all this, doing all sorts of healing and miracles and whatnot. I don't include those because, well, they're not specific accounts that we can read about. Did you?
Yeah, just in that, it says in one place that people brought people who were sick and suffering from all around, and it says, and he healed them all.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of healing going on.
Yeah, and that's later on in chapter 1, too. Yeah.
John 21:25, and there were also many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written.
That's right. That's right. So there's plenty that are talked about. And I'm sure some of these might be different instances that seem so similar that people say, oh, this must be the same thing happening in Matthew as in Mark or in Luke as in Mark. But perhaps there are some differences enough to suggest that they are different events. But I tend to think that they're pretty much the same. That's my opinion on that. So, what I want to do with all of these miracles, with all of these things that we see about Jesus and all the instances that we see, what does this particular event teach us about Jesus?
His power to heal.
His power to heal. But there's more than that. What if it was just the power to heal, he could do that with any of those 18 specific miracles mentioned in Mark.
This establishes who he is and where he's from.
Who he is and where he's from, in what way?
The demon itself admitting that he's the Son of God.
Yeah? Okay.
Which is what it says in James.
Yeah. But addressing him in human form, and his human form is Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah.
So in James it says you believe in God, you do well. The demons believe and they tremble.
Yeah, I got that.
John the Baptist testifies that Jesus is the Son of God earlier in the chapter.
Yeah.
And here you have a host. It says, "Are you come to destroy us?" and one way or the other, however many they're there, it says, "I know who you are, the Holy One of God." So you have an unclean spirit, a demon testifying that he's the Son of God.
That's right. A couple things that this teaches us, along with that, is one, he taught with authority. And not only did he teach with authority, he had the authority to teach with authority. Right? Beyond that, his identity, as Sam and Dan mentioned, his identity was confirmed by the testimony of the demons. And we see a little bit later in Mark chapter 1 and in several other instances that this was the case, that the demons couldn't help but to say, "You are the Holy One of God. You are the Messiah." They couldn't help but to express that to Jesus when he showed up. It also confirms his identity by his power over the spiritual realm. Do you have power over the spiritual realm?
No.
kindness.
With the exception, of course, your own soul, and even then you don't have that control, because when you become a Christian, it's not you who washes away your sins, it is the blood of Christ. So even then you don't have that control. You're right. Only God has that control. And so when we see that Jesus can actually cast out these unclean spirits, we see that he has that control. Is he the only one in the scriptures that we read who casts out unclean spirits?
No.
In fact, a little bit later, he says to his disciples, you will do greater things than these, than what you see, than what I've done. And we do see that later on in the New Testament account.
Well, were given the power, though, were having trouble when their faith was weak.
Yes, and in Mark 9, we do see that. Did you have something, Sam?
I was just saying that when he sent out the 70, he told them to, you know, heal the sick, cast out demons.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, the other interesting piece about this is you don't see this in the Old Testament. You see cases, you can see a couple of cases where there's some spiritual intervention going on. Spirit, God says, who's going to deceive this guy? And he says, I'll do it.
Yeah, I got...
You don't see demon possession, and you don't see unclean spirits like this. Huh. And it's a very interesting point that here's Jesus with all his power, and then all of a sudden you have these situations that he's confronted with.
So after we finish with this section, I have a bit that I want to talk about, the just demon possession in general. And I want to talk about that as well. And that's toward the end, and a lot of those things are talked about, yeah. And in fact, I do have that passage, or some of those passages you mentioned as well. All right. Why did he tell this demon to be quiet?
Maybe he was making a bunch of noise.
But what did he just say?
Yeah.
To cast out his ears.
Well, he said, you are the Holy One of God. I know who you are. But then he said, be quiet. Why would he do that?
It's not time yet.
Okay. He does that a little bit later too. In fact, throughout Mark 1 and in several other places, he says, don't tell other people about this. And he tells other demons, and he shuts them up in verse 34, the latter part, and he did not allow the demons to speak because they knew him. So because they knew him, he said, be quiet. Why? Why would that matter?
Aren't we all supposed to come to that understanding and recognition on our own?
Okay. Did you?
So you didn't want the demons to be part of his action there, whatever it might be. And if they introduced him, so to speak, then they would be part of it.
Yeah. So one of the things, you know, I was looking at some different possibilities. Sam hinted at James 2:19. Do you remember what that says? James 2:19? We see that here and in several other places that he would not, well, he wanted them to be quiet. And so part of that may have been James 2:19. The demons believe and tremble. You say that there is one God, you do well, but even the demons believe and tremble. But can they be saved? Can the demons be saved? No.
They're rebellious and don't have the access of faith.
They're rebellious.
And that's the other thing I just noticed when we were looking at this. Even after Jesus commanded him to be quiet and come out of him, he was still rebellious.
Yeah.
He punished the man on the way out, and he cried out in a loud voice. So there's still, I mean, that's the nature of Satan, and that's the nature of his servants, is they're rebellious to God.
Yeah. One possible reason is that he would not accept the confession. Is confession part of salvation?
Yes.
Yes, it absolutely is. If we confess that Jesus is the Lord, that Jesus is the Christ, then that is on our way to salvation. But what if a demon confesses? Would he be saved? No. So this is an instance possibly of where the Lord would not hear the confession of a demon. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that he did not want to be driven by the misconceptions abounding concerning the Messiah. Did people have some misunderstandings about Christ, about who the Messiah would be and what he would do? Yeah, all the way up. And even the disciples, the 12, 11, had a misunderstanding in Acts 1. Right? Will you now restore the kingdom to Israel in Acts chapter 1? They had a misunderstanding. They were assuming a physical kingdom that he would restore.
And was it the Pharisees who accused him of being of the devil?
Yes.
And one of them.
We'll definitely, I believe that's also in Mark, so we'll get to that at some point. So he cast out the demons in the spirit of the demons, something to that effect. Yeah, he did say that. All right, so there are a lot of misconceptions. Maybe someone wanted to, maybe if that word got out, people would want to take Jesus and say, oh, you are our king, let's put you up into the position of Herod or overthrow Rome, and we'll follow you to the death.
They did that.
And they did try that sometimes.
After feeding the 5,000 on the other side of Galilee, some people said, they came to make him king by force.
Yeah. But and so he's trying to prevent that. And this is early on in his ministry, and he is successful, at least for now.
There's a prophecy on this, too, in Isaiah 42. It says, behold, my servant whom I uphold, my elect one in whom my soul delights. I put my spirit upon him, and he shall bring forth justice to the Gentiles. He will not cry out, nor raise his voice, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoking flax he will not quench. He will bring forth justice and truth. And it keeps going. But, you know, there's this notion of Jesus being meek. You know, with all of his power, that he could have just gotten up on the mountain, you know, walked right up to Herod and just say, okay, Herod, you're gone. Pilate, you're gone.
He could have walked up to Rome.
And said, okay, everybody, I'm God. You know, that's not how he acts.
Yeah. He could have walked up to Rome and done that.
Just to knock it on.
Yeah. But you're right. He doesn't act that way. Oh, what is the definition, fun definition that we have for meekness? Power under control, right? And so isn't that who Jesus was? Was he all powerful? Was he God? Yes. Is he? Yes. But it's under control.
But this is the nature of free will, and I think this is a really important point. God could have created us complete robots with no will at all, right? He gave us free will. He gave us the choice, and because of that, we choose sin. And the way that he's made for us to be forgiven of that sin is by faith. And so if he comes in and takes away faith by saying, hey, absolutely no way to deny, here I am, then where are we?
Yeah.
You know, we're left in a hole. And that's part of what was going on when he said to us, you know, he healed these people and he said, don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
You know? Don't tell this until the Son of Man be raised from the dead.
Yeah.
Because he was cultivating faith.
And that was the transfiguration that you're referencing, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Another possibility, he was worried that he would constantly be accosted when he had other things that he needed to do. And once you realize, and we'll see this a little bit later on, if there's someone who can heal you coming to your neighborhood, someone that you've never seen before, are you going to go visit him? Yeah. We'll talk about that a little bit later because that is actually what happens. But eventually he actually goes away. He says, I can't go. And at the end of chapter 1, I can't be in this town anymore. I have to go to the remote places because of all the people coming at him. So he tries to get people not to talk about him and not to do that. But he is not entirely successful at that, which you can understand. I mean, how can you... That lends to his popularity. People are wanting to flock to him. Yes?
We did some... When I taught the course in the Gospel of John, we did some kind of rough estimations of just how many healed people there were during the ministry of Christ. Uh-huh. And it would have been at least in the tens of thousands.
Yeah.
And so if you had tens of thousands of people and all their families and all their relatives who had witnessed it, there was lots of talking, and it says they brought him sick people from all around the countryside. This was a throng. I mean, He got exhausted at times and had to retire just to have a place of some quietness with his disciples.
Before John the Baptist, when was the last prophet to come to Israel? 400 years. And I don't know if Malachi, the last one, I don't know if he did any healing. But the people were hungry for that kind of thing. They were in anticipation. They were looking for this person to come. And in fact, at one point, I don't remember exactly where, but the people were like, if the Messiah were to come, will he do more miracles and more wonders than these? He'd done so much for them already. All right. After this, of course, he became famous. Just this one miracle. And then we can see a little bit later that he goes to Peter's house and heals Peter's mother-in-law. And we'll see that in just a second. But I want to take a few moments, the remainder of our class, assuming that we don't finish this in between now and the end of class, to talk about demon possession. Was there, now Sam had referenced this, but was there demon possession in the Old Testament? The closest thing, and I did a little bit of research to see what the rabbis think about this, about the Old Testament, because, you know, that's their Bible. The closest thing that they could find is in 1 Samuel chapter 16, verses 14 and following. Do you remember what happened there? We talked about that in our chronology class a little bit. What happened to King Saul after David was anointed?
Just an evil spirit in him.
An evil spirit came to him. Let's look at that and find out exactly what it says. First Samuel chapter 16, verse 14. Let's see, how far? Just 14 and 15, I think it'll be fine. Whoever wants to read that, please.
But the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and the distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. And Saul's servants said to him, "Surely a distressing spirit from God is troubling you."
All right, and then he goes on, and they find David, a minstrel, who was able to play music and sing songs to pacify Saul occasionally. So this is the closest thing that we can find to a demon possession in the Old Testament. The next one Sam mentioned earlier, 1 Kings chapter 22 and verse 23, the lying spirit that had come and was come to some of the false prophets. So a lying spirit, that's not possession so much as it is influence. And perhaps maybe that's the case here with Saul, is that he's not possessed, he's merely influenced.
I think that's the point, is that you don't, if you compare either of those two cases, which is all there is in the Old Testament, that's what's remarkable about it. You've got 1,000 years before Christ, before the New Testament, and that's the only two cases you find. You don't find in the sense of they are taken without their will and doing stuff, right? Which is the stuff you see in the New Testament.
Yeah.
And you see Saul, who, you know, people want to hypothesize, and you probably get to this in some of the demon possession things. People say, well, you know, he had migraines, or he had depression, or something like that. It says a distressing spirit, or in King James, an evil spirit, right? But that's a tormenting. And in the case of the prophet, you know, the false prophets, God's saying, so how do we get this king to do my will, which is to do this thing and go be destroyed? And he says, this one spirit comes up and says, I'll be a lying spirit in the mouth of his prophets.
Yeah.
You know, so that's it. That's not the children you see, like the son says is taken and he's thrown around. That's not the legion.
Yeah.
That's not, you know, the girl in Acts who tells the future. That's none of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, whatever the case, it seems to have dramatically increased by the time of Jesus. Let's, if you're still in 1 Samuel, let's, I don't have this verse on the board, but if you're still on, in 1 Samuel, let's move over to verse, or chapter 3, and verse 1. This isn't exactly the same thing, but it is, it gives us some hint as to periods in which supernatural events occur more frequently than other times. And what does 1 Samuel 3, 1 say?
Now the boy Samuel ministered to the Lord before Eli. And the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no widespread revelation.
All right, so that's in reference to Revelation. There is no widespread revelation during this time before Samuel. So that would mean in the period of the Judges, no widespread revelation. However, in addition, we can conclude that there are different times when certain spiritual activity is more than in other times. And we certainly see that with Jesus. In the time of Jesus, the unclean spirits, the demon possession is running rampant all throughout the time. Why do you think God would allow that?
He had a reason.
To show his power. And to show the power of his son. That is the reason.
Of course, the purpose of miracles in the New Testament, and including these, what Jesus had just taught. He hadn't performed a miracle for these people yet. He had just taught, and they said, wow, this guy's an amazing teacher. He's got authority. And then he says, and he basically says, authority? I'll show you authority.
Yeah, he confirms it.
Right, it confirms his authority. And that's the whole purpose of these things.
And in fact, at the end of Mark, the very last verse, what do we see? Mm-hmm. He confirmed the word. The apostles confirmed the word with the accompanying signs, right? That's the purpose of miracles, to confirm what has been said. I have on there that... Mark chapter 6, 13 and 14, and also Acts chapter 19, 11 through 20. We don't have time to read all those, but these are moments where we see that the disciples and the apostles had power to cast out demons. And we can see this not only in Jesus' lifetime, but also in the early church, Acts 19. One of the funny things about Acts 19 is it says that Paul was doing extraordinary miracles. Isn't a miracle already pretty extraordinary? Yeah. So it's not just a run-of-the-mill miracle. There is such a thing. But it's an extraordinary miracle to the extent that these are not usual things that were going about. One of those things, he was handing out handkerchiefs. Oh, hey, baby. All right, go on to your seat. One of those things, he was handing out handkerchiefs, and the handkerchiefs were healing other people. Not the handkerchiefs exactly, but that's what some denominations...
They were taken to the sick person.
Yeah, and that's why some denominations will have justification for relics, and then some denominations, false teachers will give them something, a token, and you'll be healed by this. It's like, no.
If you pay for it,
right. Yeah. But the point is that these were extraordinary miracles. These were not your everyday, and I hate to say run-of-the-mill miracles, because how can a miracle be run-of-the-mill? But these were even more amazing than what we had seen in other instances. So, these kinds of things are not everyday occurrences. If there are times when... Now, we understand the age of miracles is over. We don't have access to that kind of thing. But one of the things I want to point out is that one of the evidences for that is that sometimes we see different situations in which, or different levels of supernatural activity going on. And certainly the time of Jesus and the time of the apostles, it was at its height, at least where human beings are concerned. Creation and the flood are pretty miraculous. But beyond that, at its height, it was at this time. Yes.
And by the end of the first century, you stop seeing it again.
Yes.
And it just kind of drills off. You don't have any major, even in the historical writings.
Yeah.
You see very little reference to it. And yeah, it was a first century thing, basically.
Yeah, that's right. All right, any comments or questions before we close out? So, it's no surprise then that after the end of the miraculous spiritual gifts, that demon possession ended too. Because will God tempt you beyond what you're able? No. You have free will. And so demon possession violates that. And if we have no ability to cast out unclean spirits, we do not have the problem of demon possession today.
What did this Christian do? Yeah.
Which one?
Okay.
1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. I didn't even get to the PowerPoint at all, but that's okay. That's for the next section anyway. All right.